Okay, so week 9, animals. Okay, we're going to talk about animals today, and the issue about what animal rights is all about, and how to think about this in the context of, well, rights, and also in terms of what kind of legal issues arise in relation to animals. Some students from the law school, though I don't believe people from this class, but some people from law school attended this debate that I had on Friday with Rupert Reed, and I did an audio of the debate, so it's a 2-hour debate. I will send you the link to it if you want to listen to it. The debate is interesting because it was over attitudes toward risk, and this actually bears on the context in which issues about animal rights get discussed very often. And so just to put this on the table for you, the two attitudes toward risk are precautionary and proactionary. And the risk, when we say risk, we're talking about a situation of uncertainty which has value implications, right? So in other words, things could end up good, things could end up bad, we don't know, but typically one needs to take a decision under the circumstances. And so we talk about decision under uncertainty as involving risk-taking, okay? And there are two general attitudes one can have. The precautionary attitude is basically a risk-averse attitude. In other words, an attitude of, if it looks like there's a chance of serious harm being committed as a result of a decision, do not take the decision. And the precautionary principle is a feature of a lot of European Union legislation with regard to environment and health, and has actually been operative in slowing down the introduction of innovations. So some of you may know, you know what GMOs are? Genetically modified organisms, right? The whole controversy over the introduction of farms devoted to these genetically modified plants, and also the foods based on them, was subject to enormous controversy in the European Union, where the precautionary principle was very much in force. A similar controversy did not happen in the United States, where the precautionary principle is generally not recognized. The proactionary principle is the opposite attitude toward risk, and you might put it sort of flippantly as no pain, no gain. In other words, the issue, you don't focus so much on the harm, but you focus on the benefit. And so the idea here is that a risk should be seen in the first instance not as a threat, but an opportunity, and an opportunity to move in a new direction, to create a new space, to make progress, and it's a very pro-innovation kind of approach. And the attitude toward harm is, you know, we will deal with it when we get to it, rather than presume it's going to happen. And proactionaries, generally speaking, take a kind of positive view of harm almost. So for example, the example I like to use of what a proactionary orientation is if you think about the Cold War. The Cold War was the period when the internet was invented. The internet was invented because you wanted an alternative way of being able to communicate in case some missile took out the entire telephone system in the country, right, in case of a nuclear attack or something like this. And so the internet was connected by operating on totally different means that would avoid the consequences of nuclear attack. Now, that kind of attitude is an attitude that, in a sense, rather than trying to prevent the nuclear attack from happening, in other words, treat it as a possibility, that nevertheless you still want to communicate, so that then provides an incentive for you to innovate and to come up with something new, an alternative technology that enables you to accomplish something. So in other words, you don't prevent the initial harm, you use that the possibility of that harm as an incentive to do something new. Okay, it's a different kind of attitude. And the argument that proactionary people make is that most radical innovation in science and technology has been proactionary. In other words, where people took large amounts of risks, often with some serious short-term harms, but nevertheless the benefits outweigh the harms in the long term. So these are two attitudes toward risk. Now the people who talk about animal rights, and in generally the possibility of there being rights to nature, rights to non-human natural things, take a precautionary attitude. Okay? And I think it's fairly clear. I mean, if you read, in preparation for this class, I was looking through some of the ways in which different defenders of animal rights set up the pretext for the argument for animal rights. Okay? And invariably, one of the things that you find is that, you know, the claim is made that while, you know, since the 1960s, whatever, the human population has doubled, the number of animal species has been cut down by one third. Right, you see this statistic thrown around, and so this is supposed to get you in the mindset, right, of thinking, my God, we're just casually, in a way, causing enormous amount of harm. Now that's a precautionary attitude, right? Because in a sense, the amount of harm being caused is itself already a problem, right? And so one then needs to have a kind of more mindful attitude. And a more mindful attitude obviously will involve some kind of reorientation of the relationship between humans and animals, and maybe humans and nature more generally. Okay? And that's very much in the precautionary framework. And then the question becomes, when you start bringing this into the legal arena, exactly how are we going to do this, right? So there are several questions that need to be asked here. Let me put one big question on the table, which you should always be thinking about, is whether we should be engaged in this project of animal rights. Let's say we actually believe that it has some prima facie of plausibility. Let's grant that for the moment. Should we be engaged in this project in a strong way, even though, as we all well know, all human beings still do not have human rights, including the rights that they are entitled to in civil law. Okay? So in other words, should we be, you know, however sympathetic we might be with the idea of animal rights, is this the time to pursue them? Or should we sort out the human rights first? Now, if you're an animal rights person, the answer is pretty clear. The answer is, to the extent that the presence of human beings is itself a problem for the rights of animals, we have got to sort these problems out simultaneously, right? In other words, that in a sense, if you were to sort out the human rights problems to the satisfaction of human beings, that may actually involve getting rid of a lot more animals. Okay, if you give people more space, if you allow them to use the environment in the way in which, more advanced human beings have done, if you allow every country in the world to be able to exploit nature the way in which the developed country has already done, right? You think about this and exploit even, you know, the farm animals and all the rest of it, that if you actually allow that to go through and that becomes some kind of proper exercise of human rights universally, where everybody is fully empowered, then that would put the condition of animals even in a worse state. This is what animal rights people worry, okay? They worry about this. Given the way in which the extension of human rights, especially in the sense of human empowerment, okay? So there's a question here about what the rights we're talking about are. But certainly, if we're talking about rights in the sense of empowerment or autonomy, right, this kind of right to self-expression, again, think about the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which is a very full-throttle kind of version of human rights. Right? It's not just a right to survive. It's not just a right to avoid torture. It's not just a right to avoid pain, but it is a right to be able to, you know, realize yourself. Okay? I mean, I mentioned this in the seminar, but, you know, if you know about Abraham Maslow, right, the self-actualization thesis, you know, the hierarchy of needs and all of this. Yes?
But can't it be said that by harming the environment in which humans live, that's also a harm towards humans themselves as well?
Well, it depends which... I think the precautionary principle would go for that. So yes, there's a sense in which you could say a self-interest argument can be wrapped into this in terms of humans being concerned about nature already when they're being concerned about humans. That's true. But I do think if you look at the proactionary guys, again, I don't want to go through the whole debate all over again, but the proactionary people would actually say that if you put nature in a subordinate position, all that, you know, and you end up, let's say, destroying a lot of nature in the process, what that does then is it may imperil human beings, and certainly climate change imperils human beings, but that nevertheless provides incentive now for us to think of alternative ways of living. And so a lot of these proactionary guys are interested in things like colonizing planets, okay? Now you might say, oh, that's crazy stuff. Wouldn't it be just a lot easier to take care of nature on Earth? And you may be right. But I'm just saying that there are different ways one can respond to this point, even granting it. But you're certainly right that even if you're just a pure human rights person, you know, you might say that human beings, as it were, are undermining themselves in the long term if they don't factor nature into the equation. That's true. I mean, that's fair enough. I mean, I think, though, that there is a more, you know, when you think about the way we treat animals. So, like, even if we were to talk about getting clean energy involved in the developing world. So, one of the things we discussed at this debate, again, I don't want to do the whole debate, but it's relevant to your question, was that the first world country should provide incentives for developing countries to develop alternative energy needs so that they can rise to a certain level, a certain standard of living, without having to have such a heavy footprint on the environment the way we have had, while we cut back our own carbon emissions and stuff like this. So this is a way of taking care of nature in order to take care of ourselves. So there are people in the precautionary mold who think about this. However, even if we were to do this, there could still be the open question about the animal rights, because that is all compatible with the idea that we still eat meat, right? And we still, you know, use animals in experiments instead of human beings, right? Those are the kind of cornerstone issues of the animal rights movement. So that even if we treat, even if, as it were, we grant a kind of normative status to nature in our legal system, the issue of animals may still remain. You see what I'm saying? Yeah, and that's kind of, and the animal rights people are more focused on that, you might say. Okay, so can I continue?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. Okay, so the notion of human rights that's promoted in the UN Declaration of Human Rights is this very empowering notion. But of course, as I've already suggested, there is a more limited notion of rights, and this is the right to avoid pain, a kind of right to self-preservation. Right? This is the kind of right that, for example, human beings have, even if they're not fully able, for whatever reason, to exercise all their faculties and assert themselves. So, disabled people and so forth have those rights, certainly, even if they cannot express themselves in more autonomous fashion. And this is the sense of right. The second sense of right is the sense of right that most animal rights people argue for. Okay? And so it's in this context that you are then concerned that animals not be tortured in experiments and not be abused, you know, or eaten for food and all the rest of it. And that is typically what the issue is about. And so now this argument is a kind of an interesting one, because one of the things, if you read someone like Peter Singer, for example, Peter Singer, when he makes the point that animal rights are based on this kind of second notion of rights about avoiding pain and self-preservation and all this kind of stuff, he is actually using this as a universal moral benchmark. In other words, he's not saying this because he doesn't believe animals aren't autonomous, and so therefore they have to settle for this. But rather, he believes that moral relevance is actually established at that level. Okay? If you look at in history of ethics, in the modern period, there are two main schools of thought. You may have run across this already. One is utilitarianism, greatest good for the greatest number. And the way this idea tends to be interpreted is in terms of a pleasure-pain principle. Doesn't necessarily need to be interpreted that way, but it often, certainly Jeremy Bentham, the person who founded utilitarianism, thought about it this way. And so the idea here is you want to minimize the overall amount of pain in the world. Okay? And so this becomes the moral threshold, the avoidance of pain at the maximum level. Now, there are all kinds of things that one can argue about exactly how do we count people's pains, right? And are my pains stronger than your pains? And there are all kinds of issues of the numerology, you might say, that underwrites utilitarianism. But nevertheless, the principle is a pretty clear one. And of course, if you put it that way, then any creature that has a sense organ is potentially part of the utilitarian calculus. All you need to do is to feel, to experience, to sense the world. That is the moral threshold for utilitarianism. It's pretty clear. And so, you know, when somebody like Peter Singer is trying to figure out what is the level of moral relevance in practice, he will look at things like whether the thing has a nervous system, right? Whether it has sense organs, right? That will be kind of a relevant benchmark for him, okay? And then all those creatures, right, are morally relevant, and they all have, as it were, their own lives that they can pursue, okay, in their own way. And the question is whether we give them the space to do that. And so this is the animal rights question. Now, what Singer denies then is Singer denies quite explicitly what the Kantian thesis is. Now, Immanuel Kant is the big man on autonomy, right? That in a sense, what and it's also about human uniqueness, right? That moral relevance is defined by the ability to self-legislate. This is the term that Kant often uses, right? Self-legislate. And self-legislation means the capacity to undertake responsibilities, right? To take responsibility for yourself in your conduct with others, right? You are autonomous in that sense, right? It comes from you. You have a kind of will that can be expressed. And of course, this involves notions of reason as well, and decision-making, and all of this kind of stuff. And indeed, Kant, you know, basically thought that we had free will. Okay, despite the fact that we have animal origins, we also have free will, and in a sense, our capacity for rights rests on this kind of freedom, a freedom to self-legislate, to take responsibility for one's actions. And this is the kind of freedom that enables one to enter into contracts and things of that kind. And so, that is the note. Now, according to Kant, and most people who think about Kant's view, Kant is really talking pretty much, he's not talking about any other animals but human beings. Let's put it that way. He might be talking about machines too. Not because Kant had some idea about robots or androids, no. Kant lived in the late 18th century. He didn't think about those things. However, his definition of what constitutes a rights-bearing being, the autonomy notion, the self-legislation notion, that those notions, because they are specified abstractly, right, could in principle be applied to certain kinds of machines that are able to, as it were, program themselves. Okay? Those kinds of autonomous machines. And so Kant certainly is inclined to eliminate the animals, but he might open the door to androids. And we'll talk more about the androids next week. I don't want to spend too much time on them. But the point is, for Singer, and for the people who believe in animal rights, this whole Kantian way of looking at things is off the table. In other words, it is not a mark of moral relevance. It may be a mark of human exceptionalism. In other words, it may be, as a matter of fact, that we are the only creatures who have this. Okay? But for Singer, that's not morally relevant. Moral relevance comes at a much lower level. It comes at this level. The avoidance of pain and self-preservation. Yeah?
I'm just thinking... John Stuart Mill as a utilitarian.
He's in between.
Because, yeah, he thinks about the quality of life rather than...
Exactly. No, that's the point. He deliberately wanted both best of both worlds. Yes, he was... Mill understood this very well and basically put himself in the middle because Mill was someone... John Stuart Mill, you're familiar with John Stuart Mill, are you? I hope. Yes? Okay. So John Stuart Mill was a follower of Bentham, but he believed in human exceptionalism. Okay, and so he incorporated some of Kant's views into his version of utilitarianism. And that is absolutely correct, because it is true that Bentham was one of the founders of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Bentham was very explicit that the value of a human life and the value of the animal life is comparable. They're comparable. Okay, he was very explicit about that in the 1820s. Very much like Peter Singer was. Peter Singer and Bentham are actually very close. And so what Mill does is, right, Mill basically tries to incorporate a kind of Kantian perspective within utilitarianism. And I think it's the kind of perspective that you could see, you know, downstream effects in people like Rawls, for example, John Rawls, and a lot of those guys. Okay? But that's a good point, right? So you can have an in-between position, you might say. They're not mutually exclusive. But the terms of where the notion of right is appealed to, they're appealed to in different ways. One is the level of autonomy, and the one is the level of the avoidance of suffering. There's a lot of interest. You know, when you look at a lot of these precautionary guys, and you look at their attitude toward human beings, okay. Obviously, if you're going to be making room for animals, so that you can live in a world where, see, the room you're making for the animals isn't necessarily because you think the animals are going to set up civilizations or something. I mean, it's not like you have these great ambitions for the animals to be able to fully express themselves, but rather you just want them to avoid harm, unnecessary harm from human beings, and especially of the rather casual, unthinking sort that we tend to do. Okay? Now, under those circumstances, you might ask the question, what exactly is the attitude of these animal rights people to human beings? And it's very clear, if you look at the guys who talk about the precautionary principle, one of the problems with human beings, very often, is that there are too many of us. And in a sense, that's part of the issue with regard to the problems of exercising rights and things like this. That human beings have to engage in a certain kind of self-discipline, right? Which, again, goes against the spirit of the autonomy and the self-legislation and all this stuff that Kant's talking about. We have to kind of downsize, downscale. We have to somehow realize that we are embedded in nature and we are part of this kind of larger community, not a larger community of other people, but a larger community of other living things. Okay? And so the distinctive value of being human is ipso facto diminished. I think that's fair. It is ipso facto diminished. Now, if you had a chance to look at this conference report that took place at Yale a couple of years ago, where I participated, Peter Singer was a keynote speaker. One of the things that Singer brought up when he was doing his keynote address was his early article, which some of you may have read in the course of your studies, on infanticide. Okay, the thing about Peter Singer is a very controversial person. The controversial nature of his views actually doesn't have to do with his positive views on animal rights, but has to do with what he says about humans, right? This is where he's controversial, because this shows a kind of interesting relationship between the human rights and the animal rights. Because the idea here is that the argument is made in this paper that that if each living thing has a right to a fulfilling life, right, in their potential, until they are in a position to do that, there is, at least in principle, an argument for termination of any species. Okay? The argument is always on the table. He doesn't say that you must exterminate people until, at a certain age. But the argument of the paper is basically to provide a moral opening for a discussion of infanticide, right? Which is where you kill kids, basically. Because kids cannot live for themselves. They cannot. They don't have autonomy. They can't live their own version of a fulfilling life. And so this is very controversial, okay? And he made comparisons which suggested that a kind of healthy pig, and this is where it becomes very much like Bentham, right? That the healthy pig versus disabled human, not so clear. The healthy pig can live a pig's life to the fullest, whereas a disabled human would not be able to live a human life to the fullest. And insofar as we want to promote beings living lives to the fullest, pig comes first. Even though the kinds of life the pig would lead and the kind of life the disabled human would lead would be, of course, different lives. See, this is where John Stuart Mill comes in, because John Stuart Mill believes a human life, you know, no matter what shape it's in, is qualitatively better than a pig's life. Right? As he says, better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. That's one of John Stuart Mill's great quotes. Okay, but with Peter Singer, it's not so clear, right? The point is, with Peter Singer, it's not so clear. There is an open discussion to be had. He was banned for many years from entering into Austria because he was seen as holding views comparable to the Nazis. Because they did hold those views. Different political framework in which they were operating, but nevertheless, on this matter, they held those views. Okay? So there is an interesting relationship to be articulated between the promotion of animal rights and the promotion of human rights. And of course, what I have just presented to you, you know, Peter Singer, I give the man credit, he's very full on, he's very much there, but of course you don't have, the relationship between animal rights and human rights doesn't need to be so polarized. But nevertheless, it does draw the point that if you're going to take the animal rights thing very seriously, there's going to be some substantial change in human behavior that's required, and perhaps even substantial change in the attitudes toward human beings. That it's very hard to escape that. So in other words, it would be very difficult to have a scenario where we extend human rights to all human beings as we normally understand the idea, and then we will do it the same for animals. Right? There's a sense in which if those two projects are going to happen, they're going to happen together, and it's going to involve some reorientation on the part of human beings. There's just no doubt about it. Okay? Does it have to be as extreme as what Peter Singer suggests, at least in a kind of open philosophical way? No. No, but it does. It is interesting to see how this would work in practice. Okay? Now, as it turns out, there is someone who's thought about this. And I recommend, I mentioned this in the seminar last week, I think. There's this Canadian political philosopher by the name of Will Kimlicka, who is known in political philosophy circles for writing about multicultural justice. Okay? In the context of Canada, where there are indigenous peoples having lots of claims, and of course, there's a historic relationship with Quebec. And so there's a lot that, you know, that's kind of where he's coming from. But now he's going to say, okay, you know, with multicultural justice, very often it is hard to make decisions as to what is comparable to what if you've got people who normally live radically different lifestyles. Okay, and in a sense, if you want to preserve the culture of these people who you're cohabiting with, how do you do that? What is, you know, what is regarded as fair and just when the cultures are so different? Now, what Kimlicka, so this is an interest, and so he uses this in a way as a kind of template for exploring the animal rights issue. Right, so instead of, you know, multiculturalism, we have multispeciesism. Okay? And so he's got this book, it came out a couple of years ago with Oxford University Press, called Zoopolis. Right? City of Animals. And we're there, we're in Zoopolis. We're one of them. Okay? And I recommend this book, because the book is a very, very serious attempt to kind of lay out a political philosophy. Right? Kind of like on the model of the sort of things that you would have got from people like Mill, for example, with regard to representative government, or you would have got from Rousseau or Hobbes or any of those guys, right, where what you're incorporating, you know, is not just human beings, but you're incorporating animals as well in some kind of overarching social contract. What are the terms of engagement for this? And I think Kimlicka is quite right in saying if we're going to really, you know, take this animal rights thing seriously, we have got to think in these terms. We have to think exactly what is the polis, what is the political structure that could accommodate this kind of view. Now, the interesting thing about Kimlicka is that Kimlicka is very alive to this distinction in rights that I've been talking about. Okay, so he's on top of that from the very beginning. And he points out that, and this is a very interesting observation with regard to animal rights. He acknowledges, you know, most animal rights people want this very thin notion of rights, this kind of avoid pain, self-preservation thing. And he suspects that the reason why they want it isn't because they don't think animals are capable of anything better, right? So in other words, he doesn't think that people who defend animal rights want this because they don't believe animals could be autonomous and engage in more full-blooded relations with humans, but it's precisely because of the consequences of that. In other words, if you were to grant that animals in some sense had autonomy and were self-legislative and could be empowered, then you would open the door to lots of relations between humans and animals, which typically we don't like. Okay? Interpersonal relations. And in fact, you would open the door again to the kinds of exploitation, perhaps, with regard to the laboratory, right? Or even people, you know, even animals, as it were, selling themselves to be eaten. That this, in a way, the door would be open for that if you actually granted that in some sense the autonomy and the self-legislation of animals could be recognized. Okay? And it's an interesting point, I think. However, this is the line that Kimlicka is going to pursue in the book. Kimlicka is basically going to try to come up with an idea of zoopolitan citizenship, right? That is to say, a form of citizenship that is the same, right? Citizenship implies equality among citizens for humans and animals, okay? And it's going to be based, as citizenship typically is in politics, on the basis of reciprocal relations. That is to say, rights with corresponding duties. So it is going to presuppose certain measure of autonomy on the part of the animal agents. Okay? Now, let me ask you a question before I go further. How many of you are willing to buy this premise? That this might be a way to go? That we could perhaps have this kind of zoopolitanism? How many of you, I mean, just put a show of hands. I haven't really told you much about it yet, but how many of you think a principle, why not? A little bit, okay. No, it's interesting. What he does in this book, and my guess is there's going to be a follow-up book on this, but in this book what he's doing is he's clearing the conceptual space to discuss the matter. One of the things that Kimlicka points out is that if we are concerned, if we're genuinely concerned about animals, especially, you know, even Peter Singer talks about the fact that, you know, animals have concerns, they have, you know, they have a sense of the future, right? They have a way of life, you know, an orientation toward the world. That if we actually are concerned about animals in that way, you know, knowing that they do have this way of orienting themselves to the world, then we should not just merely give them space so they can avoid us, which is pretty much what the normal animal rights people are about, but rather we should enable them and us to engage in as productive relationships as possible so that we can help to realize their ambitions and their dreams and their goals, however you want to describe it. Yeah.
This zoopolis idea, is it like humanity kind of designing and creating this world? Isn't the idea that we're interfering with nature's due course and allocating areas for creatures to coexist where nature had its own system to begin with?
Well, here's the thing, right? I mean, there is a sense in which nature had its own system. There is an ecosystem, as it were, and there's certainly a natural symbiotic relation among species, which has been understood even by biologists as being kind of like a political system. I mean, so there is that in nature already, you might say. The problem, of course, arises because human beings, through our interventions, have disrupted a lot of these things, or otherwise have made ourselves integral to them in ways that they often did not assent to, right? And I think that, so given that we're in that position, right, where we're actually, you know, in the middle of their environments and we're doing stuff, and we're already there, right? We have two options. One option is to kind of set up the world so that we avoid them altogether. And Kimlicka says, you know, if you really take the idea seriously, not only would you stop eating animals, but you would, you would undo, pethood would disappear, you know, all of the husbandry, animal husbandry would disappear, right? You would rewild everything. And, you know, if you really took that line, which a lot of animal rights people often seem to go down, namely, you know, put the animals in some kind of world independent of humans where they can then reconstitute themselves in some way, right? That is kind of what the normal animal rights vision looks like. So, for example, in the report that I had you read, right, the pretext for the report was this court case in New York State, right, where the lawyer, Stephen Wise, brought up this litigation to release all of these various apes who were in various forms of incarceration for various reasons. Okay? The plan was to release them into a sanctuary where they would not be touched by human hands or dealt with and didn't just be roaming around with other apes. And that's a very animal rights, normal animal rights way of doing business, okay? Where in a sense, getting them away from the humans is kind of the goal. But Kimlicka's point is, if you really are concerned about animals, to the extent that you can ascribe, you know, life plans and ambitions and thoughts and things like that, then you actually should be a bit more mindful than just doing that. You should actually think about, in some serious way, what would constitute the improvement of animal well-being. Okay? Understood in that full-throttled way of well-being that we normally think about with regard to human beings. After all, we're not just interested in human beings surviving, we're interested in human beings, you know, developing and you know, being empowered and all that. Well, we have to think harder about what that would mean for these animals, given that we are integral to their environment. And this may involve experimentation. In other words, I don't think you can say that, you know, you can just sit there as a theorist and just cook up a world, right, that would enable us to set up laws and regulations for dealing with animals. You could experiment, though, and you could try to work your way into something like this. And there could be all sorts of other dimensions to this, okay? So one of the things I think I've mentioned in the seminar, but it's always, and it's also in the review piece that I had you read, is this idea of uplift, okay? And so uplift is the idea, since we know that animals are able to think, and the more we study animals, the more we get a sense of how they think and what they think about, and we can map their minds and all the rest of it, but what we cannot do is directly communicate with them in a way that's useful from the standpoint of social intercourse, okay? And so what do we do then? Well, what we do is perhaps we try to develop communicative technologies that enable us to read the minds of these animals, and they can read our minds, and we actually kind of make some efforts along those lines. Right, because we are beginning to understand enough about how these creatures think, what they can think about, what they cannot think about. So if a creature is limited in a certain kind of way, right, and we know that, then those would, you know, then you would be able to set up laws with regard to exploitation, right? Once you understand that, but then anything that happens within the bounds that the creature is understood to be knowledgeable of or be cognizant of, then the creature is free, and you're free to deal with the creature in that context. Okay? So the point is, the more we learn about how these animal minds work, the more, in principle, if we decide to invest in the technology and whatever would be needed, we should be able to communicate the thoughts. And then we can start to talk about rules that apply and what is permissible and impermissible forms of action. This seems to, you know, why not, right? I mean, the point is, if you're concerned about animal welfare, you know, why not do that, right? We can help them live richer lives by getting more intimate with their thoughts, by understanding them better. And they could do the same for us. And then we could start talking about setting up modes of commerce and all kinds of things, just like in an ordinary society, right? I don't want to make it sound too easy. This is not going to be so easy, but it is a bit like translating across languages. Okay, how do you get people to learn the languages and so forth, and what is expressible and not expressible? And so there is a project here that could be done. Okay, and then the interesting question is, how would you sort out territorial arrangements? Because exercise of sovereignty on the part of agency, agents typically require some sense of sovereignty over land and property and things of that kind. How do you establish that for animals? Interesting question. Okay? And Kimlicka explores the possibility, for example, of overlapping jurisdictions, where both animals and humans can be co-owners, of spaces and property. And what would this be based on? Well, Kimlicka thinks that we should start with, in a sense, what we've got. In other words, there is a sense. So in other words, he's not going to tell us to rewild everything, but he is going to say, given that we do, there is a kind of stable ecosystem in which human beings are involved, let's use that as kind of the basis, but set it up in a more equitable fashion. Right? So we've got dogs and cats living at home, but are the dogs and cats living at home in an equitable fashion? Right? What would that mean exactly? You see, if you take animal welfare seriously and you want to incorporate them into the law, then you do have to think about these questions. Okay? And he's arguing that this should not be beyond our intelligence if we're serious about this, if we really do care about animals as much as the animal rights people are arguing. Can you switch? Oh, we're getting there. Okay. Okay, so now I don't know if you guys buy this kind of thing, but as a matter of fact, there are some efforts that are sort of pushing in that direction. One of the people who I talk about, and I'll stop after this because you've got to fill out these forms here. One of the people who I talk about in this report from Yale is a guy named Andrew Fenton. And he's someone who, in a way, is contributing to this discussion by trying to come up with protocols by which chimpanzees can be reasonably said to give their assent to participate in experiments. Because as you know, the standard animal rights line is you do not experiment on these animals, okay? Because you do not secure their consent, and the assumption generally is you cannot, there's no consent for them to secure, right? From them to secure. However, Fenton's argument is, well, look, in the human realm, we actually do have protocols that enable children to participate in experiments, even though they're not fully cognizant of everything about the experiment, but nevertheless are cognizant enough of key elements of the experiment that are relevant to their, suffering pain or whatever, that they can then acknowledge. Okay? And if a child can give consent to be part of an experiment, then in principle, a chimpanzee should be able to give consent to be part of an experiment once we develop the protocols of understanding how the chimp is communicating to us with regard to conditions of the experiment. Okay? So Fenton is a guy who, in a way, is making a small step in the direction of Zoopolis, right? Because he's setting up a kind of protocol that would actually allow us to recognize the autonomy of the chimp to participate in the experiment. This is very interesting. I think this is very interesting stuff. And it could go places. Okay? But I think the bottom line here is, and then I'll give this, is that however you conceptualize animal rights, it's going to change our notion of human rights and how humans are able to operate in the world. I think that is pretty clear. Right? And what Kimlicka is doing, I think, is a very kind of systematic rethinking of what's involved, but in a way that he regards, and I think he's got a reasonable case, mutually enriching for both the humans and the animals. Okay? Now I will stop here to give you a couple of minutes to.